Welcome to the deep dive. You've brought us, well, a really compelling stack of source material today. We're doing a deep dive into the memoir Becoming.
That's right. And our mission is pretty straightforward. Let's try to quickly pull out those key moments, the values, the mindset shifts that, you know, really shaped this iconic figure.
From her roots on the south side of Chicago all the way to the White House.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating study in, I guess, self-definition. She explicitly pushes back against this idea that growing up is finite.
Right. And what jumps out right away is just the sheer breadth of roles she talks about. Right. Lawyer, hospital VP, nonprofit director.
Working class, black student at a mostly white college. And, of course, first lady.
It's quite a list.
It really is. And she frames it all as a kind of synthesis. You know, the first lady role, she says it's not officially a job, but it became the place where all those other experiences sort of came together.
Hmm.
The whole journey seems defined by collecting these roles, but always staying open, you know, to more growth, never feeling like, okay, I'm done.
Okay, so let's unpack that journey. Starting with that foundation, the south side of Chicago, you really get a picture of that family apartment on Euclid Avenue. It sounds like physical constraint, but also maybe mental freedom.
Exactly. Constraint and intimacy, they seem inseparable from how she describes her identity. We read about that tiny space, right? Where her grandfather, Purnell Shields, built this, like, makeshift partition.
Yeah, to divide the room she shared with her brother, Craig.
Right. And the detail that sticks with you is them tossing a balled-up sock back and forth over the top through that little 10-inch gap.
Huh.
It suggests, you know, boundaries were there, sure, but they were permeable. There was always room for connection, for play.
And the parents, Frazier and Marion Robinson, sound like such a, well, a perfect counterweight to each other.
Totally. Her father, Frazier, is described as this bedrock of, like, silent, relentless work ethic. He's battling MS, but he treats it as his private challenge.
Kept working, even with canes, crutches.
Yeah, just incredibly stoic. While her mother, Marion, she provided this this Zen neutrality, as she calls it. Just unflappable.
Didn't rush in to fix everything.
No. Her goal wasn't raising babies. It was, and this is a direct quote, raising adults. Encouraging independent thinking.
There's that anecdote about the second grade teacher.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge early lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
So the future first lady is distressed by this teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Marion doesn't charge in making a scene.
No.
No, she quietly, strategically lobbies behind the scenes to get her daughter moved out of that class.
Ah, so the lesson wasn't just about being protected.
Not at all. It was about learning to figure out, okay, is this just whining?
Yeah.
Or is this, you know, actual distress? Is this a real structural problem that needs a strategic adult response?
That's a crucial difference. Learning when to endure versus when to act.
Precisely. Recognizing, like, systemic unfairness versus just personal annoyance. And, well, that lesson got reinforced pretty quickly by external realities, specifically the vulnerability of being black in America.
Which brings us to that that really searing story about her brother Craig getting stopped by a police officer. He'd just gotten a new bike.
Yeah, it's a moment that just defines so much. An African-American police officer accuses Craig of stealing his own bike.
Unbelievable.
And Marion steps in, delivers what's described as a brutal tongue lashing, demands the officer apologize to her son.
Wow.
And the takeaway she gave her kids was absolute, necessary. The color of our skin made us vulnerable, always. Even when you've done nothing wrong, that's a reality you just have to navigate.
That external vulnerability, it contrasts so sharply with the complex stuff going on inside the family, particularly with her grandfather, Dandy.
Oh, Dandy, yeah. Nicknamed the professor. A brilliant man, apparently, but his life was kind of a story of thwarted potential.
Son of a mill worker, grandson of slaves.
Right. And his dreams, college, becoming an electrician, they were just crushed.
Mm-hmm.
By racism, by the Great Depression. And that disappointment, it seemed to curdle into, well, frequent shouting, anger directed at the family.
And the book says she was the only one who really stood up to him.
Yeah. The only one who talked back when he yelled. It's fascinating.
Was she just being a rebellious kid? Or something more?
I think it was more. She apparently asked him, you know, what's got you so mad anyway? Like, she recognized something in that anger. Mm-hmm. Maybe saw that same stubbornness, that unwillingness to let others define your limits. In herself.
Hmm. An interesting connection between his generation's barriers and her generation's sort of accelerating drive.
Yeah, exactly. And that drive, that sense of acceleration, you really feel it when she talked about those piano recitals.
Right. Traveling 9 miles from Euclid Avenue downtown. that grand stone building on Michigan Avenue.
It's pure aspiration, isn't it? You're literally reaching for this this different, more polished world. And the detail that shows she's entering that world, it's small, but so telling.
The piano bench.
The piano bench. Realizing the baby grand there had an adjustable bench, unlike the fixed one at her Aunt Robbie's house. It's like this little click, this moment of clarity. Oh, okay, this new world, it's flexible. It's designed to accommodate you, not force you into an uncomfortable box.
But the people in charge of that world didn't always see her fitting in. There's that moment with the high school college counselor.
Yeah. Tells her she's not Princeton material.
Ouch.
It's the kind of thing that could just stop you cold. Right. But she'd been at Whitney Young, this magnet school, building up confidence among other ambitious kids.
So she didn't let it derail her.
Nope. Didn't let one person's doubt rewrite her own script. She didn't change the goal, Princeton. She just switched her method. Applied anyway.
And then Princeton itself, it sounds like it was an exercise in navigating this profound sense of otherness?
Very much so. Feeling conspicuous, feeling pressure to assimilate, feeling like she had to constantly overperform.
Why was that?
Well, she points out the disadvantages many minority students faced. Lacking, you know, generational wealth, the social connections, often things like private SAT prep that lots of her peers just took for granted.
Which is why she says...
She says explicitly, I needed my Black friends for relief, for support, against that constant pressure.
And this need for kind of validation and mentorship leads us to a really key figure, doesn't it? Cherney Braswell.
Oh, Cherney, yes. Her boss at the Third World Center, the TWC, described as an uber mentor.
What made her so important?
Well, she was this smart and beautiful Black woman, barely 30, who crucially treated her like an adult, like a professional colleague, not just a student worker, gave her real agency.
And there's that great anecdote.
Driving to New York City in Cerny's, wait for it, banana yellow Datsun.
Huh. There it is again.
Right. Smoking cigarettes, shouting directives. It was this heady taste of freedom, of adult conversation for a young woman who hadn't really been far beyond the South Side.
Okay, so the banana yellow Datsun becomes this, like, symbol of youthful chaos and freedom. And speaking of which, it reappears, doesn't it? Carrying a new passenger into her life.
Barack Obama. Arriving at the law firm, Sidley and Austin.
And she wasn't immediately impressed, was she?
Not at all. She was skeptical. Professional, rigorous, definitely not looking for romance or distraction at work. First thing she does, checks his photo in the staff directory. Describes it as a less than flattering, poorly lit headshot. Smelled of geekiness, she says, initially. Completely unmoved.
But something clicked.
Yeah, it started with simple things. Discovering he was this hybrid Kenyan father, white mother from Kansas.
Yeah.
That fascinated her. And then, hilariously, bonding over hating the musical Les Miserables.
Really? That's what did it.
Well, it showed this shared sense of humor, maybe a shared refusal to just go along with the popular thing. And then that Datsun shows up again in Cambridge to
maybe
pick her up.
The banana yellow one?
Well, maybe not the exact same one, but his Datsun. And she sees this tiny detail, this physical flaw that tells her everything about their future.
Which was?
A rusted out 4-inch hole in the floor. She could literally see the pavement rushing by underneath her feet.
Wow, that's quite a metaphor.
Isn't it? It wasn't just an old car. It was like a promise of instability, of adventure. She says it told her instantly, life with Barack would never be dull.
It certainly signaled a difference from her own, you know, carefully planned path.
A huge contrast. His approach seemed to be about risk, motion,
right,
not worrying about the polished exterior. Hers was about rigor. Planning, structure.
And that contrast, that tension maybe, gets thrown into sharp relief by a tragedy, the sudden death of her close friend Suzanne.
Yeah, Suzanne died at just 26. And it forced this major reckoning for her.
How so?
She realized she'd kind of marched myself unthinkingly into the law, driven mostly by wanting respectability, security, maybe what was expected. Not necessarily joy or passion.
Yeah.
Suzanne's death just made that need for real fulfillment feel urgent, immediate.
And it made her compare her ambition to Barack's.
Right. She starts thinking, okay, I'm trying to get myself unstuck from this path I don't love. But Barack, he's talking about getting the place itself unstuck. The community, the city.
It's a totally different scale of ambition.
Exactly. His vision of hope went way beyond just personal achievement. And that difference, that bigger vision of his, is ultimately what convinces her to leave the law firm.
Take a big pay cut.
Huge pay cut.
Yeah.
And move into public service. That shift from personal goals to a more civic mission, that's really the central turning point in her career arc, I think.
The memoir is also strikingly frank about the challenges of building a family alongside this demanding political path. Infertility, miscarriage.
Yeah, the decision to use IVF, she's very open about it.
And she describes giving herself those daily hormone shots.
Well, Barack was away for long stretches in Springfield for the state legislature. That physical separation during such a, you know, intense and shared process, it really highlights this core friction they had about marriage itself.
Because her view was more traditional.
She saw it as a full-on merger.
Yeah.
The family unit comes first, priorities merge completely.
Whereas his view
was described more as the loving alignment of two people who could lead parallel lives. You know, maintaining separate ambitions, independent paths, just aligned towards a common direction.
That's a subtle but potentially pricky difference in a high-stakes political marriage.
Definitely. And that tension alignment versus merger sounds like it was a recurring theme, a defining struggle in their early years together.
Okay, moving towards the final stage of this journey described in the book, the White House years. She addresses the ambiguity of the First Lady role right away. Not officially a job.
Right. But this non-job came with just immense scrutiny and these totally paradoxical expectations.
Like what?
Well, she's called the Princess of South Chicago. Right? A nod to her roots. But then she gets criticized as mom in chief, which kind of implies her role is just, you know, decorative or domestic.
So she had to define the role while constantly being defined by others.
Exactly. All while living inside this relentless critique machine and dealing with the bubble.
Ah, the security bubble. That total loss of normal autonomy must have been huge.
It's a major theme. She talks about that surreal feeling. Climbing into a limo with Melania Trump on Inauguration Day.
Yeah.
Just these two figures locked together by protocol, completely isolated.
And the motorcade.
The motorcade spectacle, she calls it. Sharpshooters, helicopter, doctor, always there. It might seem almost comical, the sheer scale of it.
Is there a clown car?
Right. But the reality of that hypersecurity meant she couldn't just, you know, walk out the front door for 8 years. That's a massive psychological weight.
So how did she find purpose within that bubble? How does she make the role her own?
Through tangible initiatives, things she could control and shape. The White House kitchen garden is a prime example.
Why the garden?
She saw it as her trial run, an outdoor classroom. It felt elemental, grounded, kind of apolitical. It connected back to her Southside roots, practical work, healthy living.
And the other major initiative.
Joining forces with Joe Biden. That came from realizing the huge, often invisible sacrifices military families were making. It was about recognizing and supporting them.
You know, the reflection she shares from election night 2008 is really powerful amidst all the celebration.
Right. The public perception is pure triumph, power. But she's sitting there with her mother, Marion, the ultimate pragmatist.
And Marion says?
Marion looks past the cheering crowds and just notes the gravity, the loneliness of the job ahead for Barack.
Mm-hmm. It really underscores that political power isn't just glory, it's weight, isolation.
Absolutely. And despite all that pressure, you see these conscious efforts to keep things normal, or as normal as possible, for Malia and Sasha.
Throwing balls in the hallway, letting them raid the pantry.
Having her mom, Marion, move in. These feel like deliberate acts of resistance, you know, pushing back against the gilded cage.
And she carved out small moments for herself, too.
Yeah, these little victories of free will, she calls them. Trying to maintain a connection to her old life. Making these lightning strike shopping trips to Target. Incognito in a baseball cap.
Really?
Apparently.
Yeah.
And later, she even managed to take dance classes. SoulCycle. Solid core with security. Keeping a very distant, inconspicuous watch. Little ways to feel like herself.
So looking back at the end of the term, her reflection seems to tie it all together.
It does. Despite the scrutiny, the pressure, feeling like a liability sometimes. She felt the burden was ultimately lessened because she'd chosen to live authentically, to own her story, complexities and all.
Which brings us back to the title, Becoming.
Exactly. It's the core idea. She realizes that even after all of it, Ivy Leagues, executive jobs, First Lady Audi, she still felt the need for growth. That becoming is never giving up on the idea that there's more growing to be done.
It's an incredible trajectory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Defined by that constant adaptability, that self-definition. You see the Southside influence, the ambition, but also that crucial shift towards choosing purpose.
And it leads us back to maybe the most grounding quote in the whole thing, something her mother, Marion, apparently often said about her and Craig's achievements.
What was that?
Marion would say, "They're not special at all. The Southside is filled with kids like that.
Wow, that just completely reframes everything, doesn't it? Takes it away from just individual genius.
Right. If that potential is everywhere, then the challenge isn't just about celebrating one person's climb. It poses a really interesting question, I think, for you, the listener.
Which is as.
If the kind of potential we see in this memoir truly exists everywhere, well, what hidden capacities are waiting right there in your own communities? And maybe more importantly, what structures need to be built or changed to actually allow that universal promise to realize itself?
A question that connects personal success right back to systemic opportunity. That's a powerful thought to end on. Thank you for guiding us through this deep dive.
My pleasure. It was fascinating material.
And thank you for joining us for this insightful conversation.